Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Oh, what a great track that is. I wish we could play it all, but never mind. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. You can also listen on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or you can go to sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there anywhere in the world. You can also download the podcasts, which pop up generally half an hour after each hour of the show. You've got 1 hour of science news and debate and talk in all its different forms this week. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio. As usual, it's been very, very cold coming in, so we have not cycled, I'm afraid.
No.
It will be warming up next week, though, thank goodness.
Yes.
And later in the show, we'll be talking to our PG. I think he'll be talking about the weather as well. Now, this week, because it's the second Saturday of the month, it should have been Dr. Ogo Osamoy would have been talking about cleaner, greener fuel. Maybe he'll cover it next month, but we'll touch on it very briefly today. Instead, we've got our Phil Muffett from the Mexbert and Swinton Astronomical Society. He will be on the phone later on. He's currently doing a park run, I think. He's mad. He really is mad. It's freezing. He should have been here last week, but he couldn't make it because he should have been on a powerboat course, which partly got cancelled because of the snow. Oh, very interesting. Anyway, he'll be doing Eye on the Sky, Planets and Constellations, Club News, lots of stuff. And all being well next week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, it's Gareth Moore, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. There was a big article, Sheffield Telegraph, I believe, yesterday, advertising their competition. It's an open competition this year for people to get to, you know, have a chance to get their own photography in their annual exhibition. Fantastic stuff, I'm sure. Gareth will tell us more about that next week. Before we go on any further, though, Paul's going to remind us of...
Yes, I was feeding them this morning. Again, every morning I've been feeding them all week because there's been nothing to eat.
And we've been melting water, frozen water, so they can drink as well. Yeah.
So, yes, it's the Big Garden Bird Watch. Take part in the UK's biggest garden wildlife survey by watching the birds for an hour between on the days 24th to the 26th of January. Last year, more than 600,000 people participated in the RSPB organised event. Grab a cuppa and record birds you see in your garden from your balcony or in a local park, and then log them on the RSPB website. So the details are at rspb.org.uk/birdwatch.
So that's at the end of this month, something to look forward to. Next up, I saw this in the press and I thought it was a really interesting story. Science says loneliness may really be bad for the heart. So those seeking to improve their health this year may want to check their social calendar after a study found that loneliness is linked to higher risks of heart disease, stroke and infections. Researchers from the UK and China have found that some blood proteins may increase as social isolation gets more pronounced, increasing the risk of developing several conditions and diseases. So it's been long understood that loneliness affects health, but scientists now think the mechanism behind this link may be in the blood. So a team from the University of Cambridge and Fudan University in China studied blood proteins from more than 42,000 adults from the UK Biobank, taking scores for loneliness and social isolation from each participant. They found five proteins with causal links to loneliness, including some with crucial associations to cholesterol levels and insulin resistance. So the authors of the research said that some blood proteins played a key role in the relationship between social connection and health, and some even increased as a direct result of lonelier life. Now, Barbara Shahid Kian, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cambridge, said these findings drive home the importance of social contact in keeping us well. And that's why the World Health Organization has described social isolation and loneliness as a global public health concern. We need to find ways to tackle this growing problem and keep people connected to help them stay healthy. Now, one of the proteins linked to loneliness is called adrenomegaline, or ADM, and it plays a crucial role in responses to stress. The study, which was published in Nature Human Behaviour, also found that another protein called ASGRI, ASGRI, was associated with loneliness, higher cholesterol, and increased risk of heart disease. Another was associated with insulin resistance, which is basically a precursor to type 2 diabetes. Now, Dr. Chun Shen from the University of Cambridge said, "We know that social isolation and loneliness are linked to poorer health, but we've never understood why. Our work has highlighted a number of proteins that appear to play a key role in this relationship, with levels of some proteins in particular increasing as a direct consequence of loneliness."
Move yourself, you always live
No, oh, great track. I think I've got that as a single, Loan of a Lonely Heart by Yes. A bit of a departure for them, but we played that because science is saying loneliness may really be bad for the heart, with the World Health Organization describing loneliness as a global public health concern. And talking about the research that's been done as part of that, it's to do with the blood proteins, and it's to do with the UK Biobank as well. There was another article this very week about a wider research.
Yes, the biggest study yet of proteins in the blood could lead to an explosion of discoveries in ways to treat and prevent disease. Scientists have said as they launch a massive UK-based research project, researchers are set to analyse thousands of proteins in each of 300,000 blood samples given by volunteers to a project known as UK Biobank. In doing so, they hope to understand the role of different proteins in diseases so that we can better diagnose and cure hundreds of conditions.
All very interesting. A very quick update on the environment. The UK's electricity was the cleanest ever in 2024. Burning fossil fuels made up just 29% of the UK's electricity in 2024, the lowest on record, with renewables such as wind and solar reaching a record high of 45%. Nuclear power provided another 13%. Meanwhile, sales of electric cars in the UK also rose to record levels last year, accounting for 19.6% of all new cars. And while this figure is short of the government's target of 22%, car makers can avoid penalties if they sell more electric vehicles in later years. Sale of new petrol and diesel cars also fell by 4.4% and 13.6% respectively. So diesel cars down 13.6%. Very interesting. Climate change, 2024 is also expected to have broken records as the warmest year globally since records began, and figures show it's the fourth warmest year on record for the UK. And in February this year, the Climate Change Committee will publish its advice on the greenhouse gas emissions the UK can legally release between 2038 and 2042. For the first time, the target will set out the need for governments not just to cut emissions, but remove them from the air too. Meanwhile, farmers in Essex are setting out to emulate the success of English winemakers and take advantage of our warming climate to make olive oil. Oh, very interesting. The longer summer seasons we now have make all the difference, it seems, combined with gradually increasing warm temperatures. Quickly, before we get our PG on, I'm going to have to get on with this, aren't I? Vegan dolls can save the planet and their health. I saw this article in the press. A scientist has called for the world's pets to go vegan, arguing that the equivalent of the entire carbon emissions of Britain could be saved if they stopped eating meat. Professor Andrew Knight of the University of Winchester said their health would benefit too. "We seem to have simply assumed any transition towards more sustainable diets should be limited to people, but pets consume a significant proportion of food. A medium-sized dog," he says, "eats a similar amount of meat to a medium-sized owner, and with that comes a similar carbon footprint." And in the paper in the journal PLOS One, he estimates that 6 billion animals are killed every year to feed the world's 470 million dogs. So wow. If they all ate vegan food, the world would save 570 million tonnes of carbon dioxide from entering the atmosphere every year, more than the UK emits, he said. Lewis Hamilton, who is vegan, said his dog Roscoe enjoyed and benefited from a change to a vegan diet. However, Elizabeth Molyneux, who's from the British Veterinary Association, says owners should speak to a vet before changing a diet, and that while dogs could go without meat, it was essential to cats. Who knew?
Washed it away down the kitchen.
Oh, a bit of Florence and the Machine there. Dog days are over because articles saying vegan dogs could save the planet and their health. But veterinary associations are saying do consult your vet if you're going to change your dog's diet, and that pets such as cats do need to eat meat. All interesting stuff. If you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every week. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
On this rather cold but sunny day.
Yes, bright but chilly.
I know, all being well, it'll be warming up this week.
Yes, look forward to that.
So I think everybody does, Paul. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then?
Well, I want to talk about ice, but I've got something cool from the local news first. Which is University of Sheffield are doing trials with a game-changing device to tackle arm weakness after people have suffered a stroke.
Ah.
So I had some experience of dealing with medical uses of sort of electrical impulse things when I did a program about dystonia. And it's amazing the difference that it could be made. So having known sort of family members who've suffered a stroke, it can be really debilitating. Usually left side sort of is weakened, and it starts to get in all sorts of things like just brushing your teeth, cooking, or, you know, getting around. And this device has been tested. They say that 110,000 people a year in the UK have a stroke, with many of those left facing the challenges of reduced strength. So this research from University of Sheffield and Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust is the TRICEPS trial, and it's a study funded by National Institute for Health and Care Research and Medical Research Council. So again, it's a small sort of electrical device, and it has an earpiece, fits into your ear, and delivers electrical pulses to the damaged areas of your brain to
via
the earpiece. And they're saying that could significantly improve hand and arm functions in people who've had a stroke. So if you want to find out more about it, you can go to sheffield.ac.uk. And if you look under the news heading in there, you can read the full article. But Professor Arshad Majid, consultant neurologist at the Royal Hallamshire, professor of neurology at the University of Sheffield, is leading this trial. And it's going to be, although it's supported by NIHR, Sheffield Biomedical Research Centre, you can actually look at their website, which is www.triceps, that's TRICEPS dash trial, TRIL.com, and they will be taking on more people into this study over the next couple of years. So it's potentially a game changer for people. And I say it can be really sort of isolating and debilitating, and sort of, you know, just leaves the person feeling at a loss quite often. So again, when you're talking about people's happiness, contributing into health, it's one of those things that can actually downgrade your health, is feeling useless when you've had a stroke. So wonderful bit of research, wonderful opportunity, well worth a look.
Yeah, interesting. I presume they could apply it to lots of other, you know, things that not just a stroke.
No, we've talked about it before. Parkinson's. There's a sort of a move to apply it in Parkinson's. I think anything where you've got a nerve damage or disorder, it can work. As I was never aware of dystonia before I got involved with a chap and his family who were suffering from it. And it's really a difficult thing because it affects the control of muscles and can leave people just bent double and unable to sort of walk around properly and things. And after the application of the device in the case that I was dealing with, suddenly the young lady who was affected got a chance to do what she'd always wanted to do, which was to become a dancer.
Wow, amazing.
So it really is just amazing that a few electrical pulses can make that. And obviously it's the same basis as a pacemaker for people who suffer heart failure.
Yeah, yeah. Good old Sheffield as well, in the news again.
Good stuff. And the other thing that got me, obviously, with the snap of weather we're in at the moment is something to do with ice. And news from the Antarctic, would you believe? That the Antarctic study area, and scientists have been taking an ice core. Quite often they'll take cores from lands to sample what the strata is underneath the surface. Well, this is actually taking an ice core, and it's about 2 miles, nearly. It's 2 kilometres, so it's over a mile long sample of ice. So if you imagine a giant drinking straw, solid ice, then they dug out this mile-long core, which they're going to divide up into 1 metre segments and send off to people. But the kind of ceiling, I think, for knowledge was going back about 800,000 years. And that was as far as we managed to get back. This core sample takes us back to roughly 1.2 million years ago. So someone is going to get a block of ice that's 1.2 million years old.
Wow.
And they're saying that looking through the samples, then there are some obvious things. You can see ash layers where volcanic eruptions have taken place. But trapped within a lot of the ice samples are samples of the actual air. So what we're saying that one of the exciting things is that we may be able to get a sample of the air that our predecessors breathed over a million years ago. So it's, again, when we're talking about climate change and a record of what's happened to the world, this is a great way to sort of stretch that data back by another 400,000 years.
Good grief.
So it's under Antarctica, so it's the southern version. It's not the North Pole, it's the south. And it's the team are working in temperatures of minus 35 degrees.
Oof.
And they've taken a 2.5 kilometre long ice cylinder or core, and they've boxed it up ready for shipping out to people all over the world, the samples, to have a look and see what went on. But it's expected to shed light on how the Earth's atmosphere and climate have evolved. So it's a great yardstick to see the changes, because again, currently now, even as we see things like the fires in America that are raging, people are arguing that these things aren't linked to climatic change. You talked about people in England growing olive trees.
Yeah, well, so, exactly.
It's yeah, and we talked about wine. You know, the amount of wine growing that's going on in the UK.
Yeah.
Because of the shifting climate, and I think it's the first time we've sustained the breach over the 1.5 degrees that we said had got to be the limit for change. So it's really a time for an alarm call, but tremendous bit of work. I think it's a combined study with people from all sorts of countries. The UK is involved in that study as well. And I say just the ability to get that much data going back over such a long time gives us a good sort of way to measure the changes that have happened across those years.
And it's nice that it's been shared across the world, which is similar to when they were bringing rock samples back from Mars.
Yeah,
they shared
absolutely.
Tiny bits, but they've kept a lot back, haven't they, of the rock, because they said in future, maybe 10, 20, 30, 50 years' time, there may be better technology that can work out what went off. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing. They're actually, if you go onto the BBC website, you can see a much more detailed account of it and some pictures showing samples of the ice core and the massive ice cave that they're storing the samples in. So and it's a race, don't forget, because again, one of the other things that's happening in both the Arctic and Antarctic is the ice is receding.
Well, exactly.
So it might just be a gift in time rather than sort of leaving it before we lose that kind of data.
Before you go as well, it's probably worth mentioning, I don't know if you've seen it, Digging for Britain, there's a new series of it that started on the 7th of Jan with Professor Alice Roberts. It's absolutely fascinating. We're really hooked because they're learning so much about stuff. And one of the ones they showed you was about something under the sea that's been eroded. It's the Thames, eroded by the tides, and they're having to go in and try and get as much information as they can, because in time it'll all gone. It'll just go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's the same thing in a lot of areas where things are drying out. I mean, we've got the discovery of the dinosaur footprints in the UK in a limestone quarry. That's I think appearing in the new shows on Digging for Britain.
Yeah, it's a brilliant series, and that, you know, they're saying there's lots of bits of history that they do not really understand exactly what happened. It's a bit like what you talked about with the ice, you know. They're going to try and glean information from it.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, like a lot of things in terms of discovery, sometimes people try to make the data that they've uncovered fit an idea. Other times they're trying to find data to consolidate an idea that they've got. And sometimes it can be very difficult to separate the two out. So that's why every so often you'll get somebody come up with an earth-shattering theory that's slightly wonky. So I think it's one of those things to gather data, to keep knowledge and to share knowledge.
You know, it's like Digging for Britain and what they're doing in the Antarctica. It's all about the using the latest technology, aren't they, that's available to us now that wouldn't have been available, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, if you imagine trying to drill for more than a mile deep.
It's just, in ice.
Yeah, you know, I mean, imagine, I find it difficult to drill a hole in the wall to put a plug in, you know.
I'm with you there, Paul, on that one.
Indeed. Great stuff, Paul. All being well. We'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Hurrah.
Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye, Paul. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye. Right. Stay warm.
Bye, guys. And you. Cheers.
You never take
bit of Foreigner there, cold as ice, and indeed it is cold. But RPG was talking about the study in Antarctica and about the ice core and the samples that have been sent around the world. All interesting stuff, but it's made me feel even colder. Anyway, if you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. We should have Phil Muffett on the line. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Oh,
morning.
You're sounding very deep and husky, Phil.
Barry White.
Thank you very much.
Barry White's on the phone. No, it's not. Happy Barry, New Year, Phil, anyway.
Happy New Year to South Yorkshire.
Brilliant. And you couldn't be with us last week because you had a better offer of a powerboat course.
Yes. And the Saturday went fine, but unfortunately, Sunday, the
got snowed off.
I'm doing the second half in a fortnight.
Oh, yeah. So what have you done? Have you done the theory? Is it all practical?
It's practical. Well, we've done practical and theory. So we had, some classroom tuition, and then they took us out on the lake in a very large speedboat with a centre console, which has got a very, very floppy steering. You'd think a steering wheel and a speedboat would be a lot more easy to do than a tiller, and I found it a lot more difficult.
Did you? All I realised when I did my powerboat course that I could, unlike a dinghy or a yacht, well, in a dinghy, I could turn it as fast as I wanted, and I couldn't capsize it.
Oh, right.
And you can go in a 360-degree circle and not capsize, which I thought was amazing at the time.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't recommend that in Manders.
It wasn't for me.
No. Everybody else was feeling sick at the point. But anyway, you were saying that Manders Waterfront Boat Club today, people are actually swimming, doing cold water swimming.
Yes, they've been swimming all over Christmas. Words. Yeah, there's ice on the lake. So, yes.
But it's all controlled there, so it's all safe.
Yes, yeah, that's true. There's lifeguards and there's loads of protection and there's people on hand to deal with people with any issues when they come out of the water. But people have been building up to this. I mean, they swim all year.
Yes, they don't just jump in when it's freezing.
Right. They've been in the water when it's been 20-odd degrees and now it's got down to, 2 or 3. So...
Ooh,
it might be ice on the surface, but it's a couple of degrees warmer underneath.
Yeah, it's still cold. Not to be recommended unless it's in controlled circumstances.
Well, yeah, exactly. If you want to do open water swimming, join a club that does it. Don't take life.
No, don't do it on your own bat. So, for people who don't know who you are, Phil, you are a member of the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
Good plug.
Which to me sounds like you need a bigger premises now, don't you? You've got an observatory at Hoover Stand, and you had just after Christmas, I think it was the 28th of December, I think, you had a Santa, if Santa brought you a telescope, come to our observatory and we'll help you.
Yes, so Paul de Silva has organised a few of these now. I think we're probably 5 or 6 now, and I think we had about 30 people up to the observatory. They bring whatever they've got for Christmas, whether it's small or large telescopes, and it's like you get an instruction booklet. And to be honest, if you're a novice or you've not done it before, it's usually quite bewildering how to put it all together.
Yeah.
And then there's how to polar align it, what you can do with it, what you can see with it, and how to set it up. It's just a minefield. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think people could also take binoculars as well, I think, not just telescopes.
I still use binoculars. It's things like Uranus and even asteroids and comets. But sometimes what I do is I suss the patch of sky out that I want to look at just so I can familiarise myself with the stars. And then when you look through your telescope, you're then starting to look at the fainter objects that you're actually wanting to look at. So at the moment, I'm trying to get the best out of my iPhone camera so what I can photograph. So the other night I was looking at the Crab Nebula, which is about magnitude 8, which is well below naked eye visibility. And it was taking my camera about 10 seconds before I started to get an image of what I wanted to look at. So at the moment, my phone will do about 30-second exposure, and I can see certain galaxies and nebula appear in your phone. So, yeah. But you need a special adapter to fasten your phone to your eyepiece. Otherwise, it gets a bit messy.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, hey, you have said, because of the weather's been so cold, you were saying it's been really good for observing.
Yes, cold weather's really, really good. Dry cold weather's the best, but it's a little bit humid. So
Is it?
Well, when I say humid, there's moisture in the air.
Ah, right, yeah.
When I say humid, there's moisture in the air.
I think of bit humid as being warm, Phil.
Yeah, yeah. So there's so much. The thing is, if there's any moisture in the air, when it's really cold, it condenses out as fog and then ice. And the problem is, you get your gear out, set it up, and if you're not on the ball, do what you want to do. And take your images or see your objects, what happens is things start to freeze up.
Yes.
You get like ice on things, and then eventually your lenses and your mirrors can get iced over as well, which is not what you really want, because you'll start lose things and damage your equipment. And then the other thing is, don't take it into your kitchen, because it'll just condense and everything will get wet through. So what I've been doing is I've got my telescope and mount in the garage. So what I'll do is I'll plan me evening, so I'll say, well, I'm going to do an hour. I've been doing asteroids and planets at the moment, and what I've been doing is working out when the best visible, or the moon even, getting your gear out, set it up, do your imaging, and then once you're finished, put it
away.
Yeah,
get in quick.
That's right, because the other thing is, if you do too much, what can happen is things can start to go wrong, and then you end up finishing on a bad note, and then it puts you off for next time.
It sounds like that sounds like somebody talking from experience, Phil.
Yeah, I've been doing it like 40 years.
So you know not to push your luck and come away a downer, basically.
Well, the other thing is as well, cold on your body. I mean, you really need to think about what you're going to wear when you go outside.
Yes.
Because your head gets cold, and then you don't start to think properly, and you get that, I forgot what the name is now, when you
hypothermia. Hypothermia,
yeah. Well,
maybe.
That as well?
It's the start of it, isn't it? That's the first sign of it, yeah.
Yeah, your brain starts to lag. You make mistakes, you can't think straight, you drop things. You pick things up in your hand and you can't feel them. They slip out your fingers. You drop an eyepiece that might be 40, 50 pounds.
Well, yeah.
And suddenly start breaking stuff. So it's really important. But I do try and keep a pair of gloves on these days.
I was going to say, how do you manage with gloves then?
And yeah, well, you can do some stuff with gloves. But then when you're twiddling with screws and levers and stuff, sometimes of picking eyepieces up, you probably need to take your gloves off and then put your gloves back on again. And the other thing is, cameras can freeze up. I was once went to Tenerife. I went with my wife when we were younger for a holiday, a romantic holiday in Tenerife. Hired a car, and we went up onto the top of the volcano as high as we could. I think we're about 6,500 feet up above the clouds. Got the Canon camera out on a tripod to try to do some constellation photographs. I think I managed 6 photographs, and the camera packed up because the cold just stabs all the energy out of the battery.
So this was a romantic holiday with you and your wife, and there you were. Tom, is it Mount Teide? I think it's Mount Teide.
Yeah,
I think we've been there, yeah. So you're up there, and your main concern was taking photographs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. and the really funny side, that my wife decided to lock me out of the car.
Oh!
and made me suffer a bit at my expense while I was freezing.
Well, there you go. Oh, I must have known.
Yeah.
Eh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All these holidays you go on with the pretext that, we're just going on this lovely holiday, and it turns out to be one of your jollies for you.
There's a storm circle, or there's an observatory. Yeah, brilliant, really good.
Brilliant. But you always said this time of year is great for observing anyway.
Yeah, it is, because you can observe at an earlier time. I mean, it starts by 5 o'clock-ish. So you can do some sensible observing at a reasonable time and then pack up, when it gets a bit too cold. Whereas in the summer months, it's not as dark and you're doing observing about midnight.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a lot different. You've got to stay up late, haven't you? Get up early or both.
Yeah. The only problem is this time of year, the first couple of weeks, months in the year, it's always really, really cold. So hence, I don't know where I picked the cold up from, by the way.
No, you don't, but, yeah. You've not been very well, Phil, have you? Oh, dear. No.
It feels like another COVID virus, to be honest, because I've had a really couple of bad nights.
I think there's been a lot of stuff going around, though.
There has.
At this time of year. So what else is worth looking at? You mentioned Crab Nebula.
The planets are really good. Mercury's in the morning at the moment, and there's also a very bright comet just before sunrise. But I don't think we're going to see it from the UK because it's too close to the sun. But then in an evening, that really, really bright star after sunset is Venus. And then closely after that, we've got Saturn and Neptune and Uranus as well. And then we've also got Jupiter, which is the other bright object in the western sky, which is really high up in the sky. In fact, last night and tonight, the moon's really quite close to Jupiter.
Ah.
And then more to the left, Mars is rising. It's a really, really bright red object. And it's just under two stars in Gemini called Castor and Pollux. Now, if you're lying Castor and Pollux up, it points down to where Mars is. And on a nightly basis, you can see Mars move under these two stars.
Wow.
So you can use the stars as a reference to see how Mars moves across the sky. So I think you can see like seven planets in an evening quite easily at the moment. So that's really worth doing.
So, but if you've never done it before and you want to try and find those stars to guide you to Mars,
yes.
What's the easiest thing to do? Look at heavens above or one of your apps?
Yeah. Well, there's the phone app, there's the Stellarium, and there's also the Celestial Sky Portal, really easy to use. And when you point it at the sky, it'll also show you where you're looking. Mars is kind of in the southeast, and it'll be rising in an evening. It's a really, really bright red object. And then you'll see two bright stars above it, which is Castor and Pollux in Gemini. So, yeah, it's a quite good object to look at. And it's getting brighter. It's also getting higher in the sky during the month. So it'll be easy to observe.
Yeah, brilliant.
And Jupiter's more or less overhead. That's really, really bright as well. And you can see the moons easily with a pair of binoculars. So that's worth looking at as well.
Excellent. So going back to your club news, you're on Facebook. You're also on, I think you're also on Twitter or X as it's now called. I did notice that quite a lot of your events are selling out on Eventbrite.
Yeah. I think they must be well advertised. And the thing is, I think people must be waiting online. And then after, when it gets to 12 o'clock, I suppose it's like when you get concert tickets.
As soon as
they come online, people apply for them. And the thing is, they're all going in about half an hour.
Really?
So if you're not on the ball, they're like they've gone.
So you do, are they monthly? Is it monthly events at your observatory in Hoover?
Yeah, we used to do Fridays and Saturdays, but we've had to downsize it to just doing it on Fridays. But we're also doing outreach events, which we do Saturdays. So we can't do an event at the observatory and an outreach event at places like Clifton Park and Wentworth, because it's just too much.
Because most of you are working as well, aren't you? As well as doing this is your hobby, yeah?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, yeah.
Do you think you're becoming more popular then?
Well, I'm hoping so. But I think astronomy is better advertised these days. It's things like on Facebook, on the internet.
Yes.
There's loads of stuff being...
Makes a big difference.
Put out there, and I think people are just getting more interested. And I think the other thing is, equipment's a lot more cheaper now than it used to be, or people have got more available cash to spend on stuff that they wouldn't do before. I mean, you know, I've got a couple of grand's worth of equipment. I mean, I just wouldn't have thought about buying expensive equipment when I was younger, because you've got other priorities. But things are getting cheaper. But they also, the technology is getting better,
yeah.
So that your results are better. So it's like taking images. When we were starting, we were doing, we've got a Zenit TTL camera with something like 400 ASA film, and you do like a minute exposure to try and catch something, and the motor drive might not work on the telescope or something like that, or whatever. Now you can get a small telescope, half the size, and the electronics and the driving gear and the camera equipment's all digital, and it's just so much more easy to take a photograph, and you can like actually see and take a photograph and be comparable or even better with photography, because CCD chips now are so good.
Yeah, it's amazing how the technology moves.
And then there's auto stacking, there's image stacking. You can get programs to stack your images on your phone and see so much more than what you can actually see with your eye. Excuse me.
Oh, it's all right, Phil. You're doing very well. I thought you might at some point go, I can't talk anymore. You did. I'm pretty sure you put a cracking photograph up of the moon a while ago.
It wasn't. It's not one of my best.
Is it not?
But
no, wait, I thought it looked good.
Well, it's just getting the focus. It was a setting moon. So it was that cold a couple of nights ago. I've actually got the telescope in the garage. I noticed in my side door, I could see the moon. So from my garage, I'd set a telescope up so I could take a photograph of the moon out of the side door in my garage. So it was kind of setting. The problem is, the lower the stuff is to the horizon, the more you get atmospheric aberration.
Oh, right, okay.
More difficult to focus. So it wasn't all in focus, although some of it was. But yeah, it's another thing is the more you magnify it, if the weather's not spot on, you get like movement in the atmosphere, and it kind of brings things in and out of focus. So it's tricky to, you know, if you're doing a large image, it's difficult to focus it crisp and get it crisp.
Yeah, but it still looked good to me as a.
It was reasonable.
It was reasonable. It must have been good enough for you to put up on Facebook, Phil. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. You must have been proud of it. Well, because I suppose technology wise, that's something of that quality, even you wouldn't have even been able to do that 10, 15 years ago.
No, you're right, yeah. Since the 2000s, things have just mushroomed. And the other thing is that the mountains and tracking systems you get for telescopes are so much better. So what I've done is I've spent more money on my actual mount and my drive system than I have on the telescope. And then you get a really good camera or a CCD chip. So long as you've got the stillness and you can track stuff, you get like better pinpoint images. But some of the programs you can get now to process your images will take out the fuzziness and clean the pictures up. So everything's better. Everything's better.
Brilliant.
And of course, there's the go-to telescopes now, the C-Stars. So the 50mm C-Star, there's a couple in the club now. And they're stopping using the regular telescope.
Are they?
Because all they do is they look it up on the phone, tell the C-Star where to point, and take an image. So some of the guys have been doing a couple of hours exposure. So they're in the front room watching TV.
No.
Having a drink with a telescope in the bottom of the garden, taking a two-hour image of an object in the sky.
Really?
And then it comes through on your phone. And you can buy these things for about £500 now. And the better images are what I'm doing on my telescope.
Oh, so this is a modern way, is it? Is this where everything's going then?
They're like robotic telescopes. But you don't look through them. What you're doing, they're actually an imaging device.
You're controlling it by something else.
There's a bit of friction between what these things are, because people call them telescopes, but I don't think they're real telescopes. They're actually imaging devices. The cameras in a mobile tracking system, so you can track objects and photograph them.
But I guess
you don't actually look at them through the eyes.
I guess that's because people want great images.
Yes.
It's not just the joy of looking at it, is it?
Yes. Yeah. It depends what angle you're coming at. So my interest is in astronomy, looking at things, finding things, and discovering things, and seeing things. For the first time, some people want to capture a pretty picture. So we've got a photographer in the club, and he's actually just capturing images.
That's what he is
in the sky.
Yeah,
he's. I don't think he's interested in the astronomy side.
He's interested
he's
in
interested
the tech,
the photography,
in the technological challenge.
Really good. That's right.
Yeah, interesting one.
So I'm interested in seeing objects and capturing them, like I can see them.
Yeah, I understand. Well, interestingly, Sheffield Photographic Society They have an annual competition every year for their club where somebody comes in and judges the images, and that's generally at the Sheffield Cathedral. But this year, for the first time, they've opened it up to the public. I think you have to live or work in Sheffield or be associated with Sheffield's. Yes. But I just wonder if there'll be any astronomical images being submitted.
Could well be.
Because I think it's an interesting discipline, isn't it, of photography? It's very specific.
It is. The setup I've got at the moment is quite good on stars and brighter nibbling objects. The planets, I'm really struggling because the planets are too bright for my gear. For me, phone, and they just end up being white. The moon's kind of an intermediate thing. It's large, bright, but I can adjust the tone enough to see craters and contrast. So the moon's quite good. To be honest, if you're going to photograph stuff, start on the moon, try and do some constellations, one wide angles. And the planetary stuff, it starts to get quite technical and tricky to do, and you need magnification to see anything. And Venus is really tricky because it's so bright and there's no contrast on the clouds. You just end up with a white blob. But if you're really good, you can actually catch the phases of Venus as it's travelling around the sun. It's like the moon. It starts off as a crescent and then gets bigger and bigger to a gibbous phase. And then it starts getting smaller again. So Venus is good to see the phases, but you can't see the surface because it's just cloud. But it's a really tricky object because it is so bright. And it just ends up flooding your CCD chips in your camera.
Yeah, amazing.
And if you want another good target to people observing, Orion's more or less due south in an evening, probably about 8 o'clock. And, of course, there's a great Orion Nebula. It's an absolute cracking object to look at and photograph as well. And you'll also get some colour out of it as well. It's like a pinky colour.
Well, I'll be looking for some photographs on your Facebook page then.
And there's also Uranus is a target to look out for underneath the Pleiades. You can see that with binoculars. It looks a bit like a star, but you can get a disc out of it, and it's moving around underneath the Pleiades. So that's a good target to aim for. So it's something you can actually find by using other stars. But you want a phone app so you can identify where these objects are.
Where you're looking at. Well, on that note, Phil, I'm going to have to let you go. You've done amazingly well.
Thank you.
You did. The huskiness wore off, Phil, as you went on.
Need a drink now.
Oh, no. Bless you.
I hope next week's okay for observing anyway. The record's going to warm up a little bit.
Yes. All being well. Amazing. Great stuff, Phil. As always, thank you for your time.
You. Well,
and spreading your knowledge.
Lovely.
Okay. Take care, month. Phil. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
your guide.